all the repressed people. Nobody a plane or a train in Belfast and not immediately see the material and social differences between the Irish Catholic population and the Ulster population. Now, what is going on in Northern Ireland today, and I'm going to sum up, is basically a civil war. No, excuse me, it's not a civil war. It is a war against imperialism that has some civil connotations. A portion of the Irish population has sided with a British occupying force and is repressing the Irish people. Lord Diplock, and I'm not going to go into it at length because we have documented it here before you. It has been documented by the European Commission on Human Rights. It has been documented by Amnesty International. Has strayed so far from what you here may cherish as the traditional civil safeguards that he has in fact put himself out of the pale of civilized human beings. He and his report and the forms of denial of justice that it produced is symbolic to every Irish person in the North of what it means to be deprived of liberty. Wide police powers, the ability to be picked up and held incommunicado for 7 days without even being able to contact your family. Interrogation and the possibility, I'm finishing, the possibility of being tried and convicted out of the sight of public, not being judged by your peers in a jury, and furthermore, to be tried only on the basis of a confession that is extorted from you or the verbal evidence of an occupying police officer's testimony. Is that justice? Is this man worthy of talking about the role of the courts in the 80s? Unless for every person in this room, he has in mind a perversion of what limited liberties the existing court system may even give. Today, 4 people are on hunger strike to touch the conscience of the world, who demand that an end be put to what Diplock did for the British, criminalization of political prisoners, people struggling in a political cause, not crimes like petty thief and what have you. I ask you to read the leaflet. I ask you to study it. I ask you to ask Lord Diplock questions. I ask you to read that Vancouver Sun editorial, which wasn't such a bad exposure of the situation. I thank you for your tolerance. I only wish Diplock's system gave us much tolerance in Northern Ireland, and thank you and good evening.
Would you please clear the hallways? If you cannot find a seat, there is another room that is open. We will open up number one next door so that you can sit down. Regulations do not permit us to go on with the entrances and the steps full of people. You will have a chance. You will have a chance to hear. You will have a chance to ask questions of Lord Diplock afterwards. Thank you. Thank you very much for your patience, ladies and gentlemen. After serving in the war in the Air Force, he was appointed to King's Counsel in 1948, Recorder of Oxford in 1951. And his distinguished career as a judge began on his appointment to the Queen's Bench Division in 1956, followed by his elevation to the Court of Appeal in 1961, and his creation as a peer and Lord of Appeal in Ordinary in 1968. His judgments are noted for their scholarship, their elegance, and an element of dry humor which surfaces from time to time. I think it is fair to say that he will be remembered as one of the half dozen English judges who have had a marked impact on the common law of the century. But while we may know him as a judge and legal scholar, and the recipient of many honorary degrees, including, by the way, one from the University of Alberta, and are not surprised at those honors, few know of his remarkable record in fields outside the courtroom. He's been president of the Institute of Arbitrators. He's been chairman of the British Maritime Law Association, and in this field alone, he has made a marked contribution in the formulation of international maritime conventions. And he was chairman of the commission dealing with terrorist activities that you've just heard about in Northern Ireland, and which has drawn the disapproval of some of those here tonight, and on which he will answer questions after his talk. He was for 10 years chairman of the permanent, and still is, chairman of the Permanent Security Commission of the United Kingdom. Finally, what is evident is the deep interest that Lord Diplock has in the interplay between law and society. He was a member of the Lord Chancellor's Law Reform Committee and has written a good deal about reform of the law and the role that academics can play in it, in spite of his non-academic background. And he has given a number of notable addresses on topics of general interest. His presidential address to the Holdsworth Club, the courts as legislators, his address to the Hebrew University in Jerusalem on the role of the judicial process in the regulation of competition, a subject with which he was well acquainted as a former judge of the Restrictive Practices Court, and his address in the University of Cambridge Administrative Law Judicial Review Reviewed. These lectures all bear on the subject of tonight's talk, the role of the courts in the 1980s. The Right Honorable Lord Diplock.
Mr. Lobia, ladies and gentlemen, first let me apologize for the inconvenience you've had earlier in this evening. I didn't realize I was so unpopular, so far away from my hometown. I was...
I think I'll just put this up a bit now.
Is it on?
Yeah.
Set this up somewhere or another.
I'm glad Dr. Shrum is doing this.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me up at the back? I always say those who can't hear me hold up their hands, because it's the safest way of getting no hands held up. I think the trouble about the courts is that people expect too much of them. It is not the arm of government that can solve all our social problems. It has its limitation in what can be done through the courts. First of all, it must be remembered that the courts do not initiate actions or proceedings before them. Someone has to press the starting button before anything comes out of the courtroom at all. I remember one case in which Lord Denning, in his eloquent language, said of some as he thought, wrong act by the government, by some governmental authority, must the courts stand idly by? The answer is, it is the function of the courts to stand idly by until someone comes along and asks them to decide a dispute. And it must be a real dispute on matters which require a legal remedy and decided upon the facts which are adduced before the court by the parties. I was at the University of Victoria earlier this week, and being cross-examined about some case which I had been a party to deciding, which was between a composer and some music publishers, and the question was whether this was an unreasonable restraint of trade. And we held that it was. And I was chidden for this, my part in this decision, because it was said that there had been done after the decision a great deal of research into the facts about music publishing, and it showed that we were wrong in our facts. If we had to decide the case upon the facts put before the parties, put before us by the parties, it is not for the court to go out into highways and byways and find out the facts for itself. And that is one of the limitations of the judicial process when you are seeking to find through the judicial process solutions to social problems. And except in the case of the rather anomalous advisory jurisdiction of the courts, which is so seldom used, but I gather is going to be used shortly in this country, it is chance which dictates the order in which cases come before the courts. And a good deal may turn upon whether the case which comes before the court in which a particular point of law is raised is a meritorious one or an unmeritorious one, which dictates the way in which the law is going to be move. So this is an imperfect method of solving major general social problems. The third limitation upon the powers of the courts is that their powers are judicial only. The court decides disputes about legal rights. In deciding those disputes, it has a limited choice of remedies. It can award monetary compensation in the form of damages. It can give negative injunctions or declarations, but it relies entirely upon the executive for the enforcement of its decision, and it has no supervisory powers of its own, so that a prohibition from doing something rather than an order to do something which would require supervision is the only kind of remedy which it can provide. But though the court has no executive powers, it does legislate through judicial legislation in two ways. First, by interpreting the written law, And whoever has last word on what the written law means is exercising a legislative power. The other respect in which it does so, does legislate, is developing the unwritten common law. For although there is a vast deal, much too much, statute law growing every year, still much of our concepts, much of the way in which our lives are regulated is left to the unwritten common law, which was judge-made and can be judged-developed. The scope of the legislative work of the courts in interpreting the written law depends very much on the detail in which the written law is drafted. And that runs through the whole gamut. I suppose that probably, where one has a written constitution, where so little is said expressly and so much taken for granted, that the interpretative power of the court has a great influence on the way that the constitution develops, because one interprets a constitution as something that is not a steel, rigid structure, but something that is flexible and adapts itself to the changing conditions of the time. And one has seen that in the United States Constitution. We are seeing it now in the European Economic Community, where the Court of Justice has probably done more to develop the extent of the community legislation than any other organization. And although we have no written constitution in England, we do in the Privy Council have constitutional matters to decide. Bills of Right incorporated in the Constitution too. And there is a very wide field in which the judges, through their decisions, clarify, extend, and modify from time to time the Constitution to meet the needs of the moment. Then finally one comes, perhaps en passant, one passes through the bills of the Bill of Rights, where one necessarily, they are cast in the broadest and absolute terms, but with escape clauses or exception clauses, for these are essential for what is required in a democratic society for the defense of public morals, public safety, and the like. And that means that it puts into the hands of the court, the final court, the decision of what is necessary for public morals,
public health, public safety, or whatever it may be. And I shall return to that a little later in my talk this evening. Then let me come to the other way in which the judges legislate, the courts legislate. And that is in the field of the unwritten or common law. And there are really three fields here. That which deals with the relationship between man and society, the criminal law. That which deals with the relationship between man and government, administrative law. That which deals with the relationship between man and his fellow man, the civil law. I propose to exclude from anything I say this evening the fourth field, that which deals with the relationship between man and woman, that is family law, because that has never been my line of country. You will be all aware, I expect, that in France and in Quebec, and that's why you will be all aware of it, the civil law is incorporated in a code, whereas in the common law countries it is left to the common law. The administrative law in this country is judge-made almost entirely. And that is equally true of the civil law countries of France and of Germany, where droit administratif was invented. It is all, or nearly all, judge-made law, though made by a different set of judges in administrative courts instead of in the general courts that deal with it in the common law countries. And what I'm going to look at this evening for a time is to examine in each of these fields what kinds of disputes are those which the courts can deal with well and efficiently, what ought to be left to some other machinery for solution, and secondly, how can the decision-making machinery used in courts of law be improved. And I will start first with criminal law, because that, I think, speaking to an audience unlike the others which I have spoken to since I've been here, which are composed entirely of lawyers, I think the public do feel that criminal law and its effective administration is something which is of preeminent importance in this, at this time, where we are faced, I think you're faced with it less in British Columbia than we are in England, but apart from this fortunate province, throughout the industrialized world, we are faced with an enormous increase in crime, in organized crime, in crime of violence, crime against which the citizen feels
that it is the state owes him some protection. Indeed, the maintenance of the king's peace was the first task of government in medieval days. Now, the functions of the court in the criminal law are to acquit the innocent and convict the guilty. And justice miscarries as much when a guilty man is acquitted as it does when the innocent is convicted. And just if you would analyze for a moment that phrase one often hears, it is better that 100 guilty men should be acquitted than one innocent convicted. That is about as rational a statement, and as true, as saying that it is better that 100 guilty men should be acquitted than one man should be killed in a motor accident. For it does not follow that by acquitting 100 guilty men, you are any more likely to prevent an innocent man being convicted than if you adopted some better way in the decision-making process to ensure that justice does not miscarry that way. And the third task of the courts in criminal law is to determine the punishment. Now, so far as prevention of crime is concerned, detection, which is a police function, is no doubt the best, the likelihood of detection is the best way of diminishing crime. But speed and certainty of conviction if guilty plays its part. We have had an example of that of recent years in England with the breathalyzer provisions of the Road Traffic Act, through which, through the ingenuity of counsel, so many loopholes have been found that the good effect it had in the first years has almost disappeared with the result of loopholes that have been found in it. So the chances of conviction are sufficient, or of acquittal despite guilt, are sufficiently great to have brought that part of the law, criminal law, into contempt. And I think we have got to rethink our trial procedure. I think we've got to ask ourselves, because in an audience which is not composed entirely of lawyers, I think I can say that we should have as one consideration to bear in mind that cheapness in the administration of justice is something to be aimed at if we can. And I think we'll have to think, is jury trial essential? And if so, for what crimes? Jury trial is, after all, an historical survival. It has the effect of doubling the length of time of a trial. And I'm aware that in Canada, in some of the provinces at any rate, a jury trial is becoming quite uncommon as a matter of practice in criminal cases. In England, we have been, or Criminal Law Revision Committee has been making proposals for extending non-jury trials, for limiting the number of crimes and limiting them to the most serious in which a jury trial can be claimed by the accused. And if we were to limit those rules of evidence, were created at a time when jurors were for the most part illiterate, and where the prisoner was not entitled to give evidence himself in his own defense. And that was a very good reason for being extremely strict in the evidence against him, because he was not in a position to go into the witness box and give evidence in his own defense to contradict it. We have abolished the strict rules of evidence in civil cases in England now. The retention of those strict rules flows from the distrust of the jury. Juries, I venture to think, today are perfectly capable of weighing the probative value of evidence as a judge is, except with one exception, that a judge is perhaps more used to doing it when the evidence is presented in this sort of form than is a jury. But if you can't trust a jury to weigh the value of the evidence as a method of proof, then ought you really to be trusting the jury to decide the question of guilt or not? Another thing I think we've got to consider, and I'm not quite sure how this works in British Columbia at present. The accused need not give evidence on his own behalf, because compulsory self-incrimination is something which is repulsive or distasteful to the general public. But if he doesn't, why should not the inference be drawn, which is the inference of common sense, that if he had got some explanation of the prima facie case against him, then he would go into the box and give it. I'm sure that juries pay great attention to the fact that whether the prisoner has gone into the box or not. And if he hasn't, they draw the inference unfavorable to his innocence. Next question, I think, for the courts to consider is, are we making detection and proof of guilt too difficult by the technical rules which we apply to the conduct of the police and of the prosecutor before the case. The right to detain a suspect suspected on reasonable grounds for purposes of interrogation. Strictly speaking, in English law, and I suspect in the law of British Columbia, Canada, there is no right to detain a suspect who wants to leave unless you arrest him. And when, once you have arrested him, then the judge's rules apply and you can no longer go on interrogating, because you've got to tell him what you're arresting him for. Now, if you make unreasonable rules for interrogation of police conduct before the prosecution starts, it will inevitably make the police bend the rules. To make a rule which hampers them and which they think irrational and unreasonable, then they are not going to follow. And I would suggest that we are tending to get such complication and such rigid rules about the conduct before the prosecution, that we are getting into the same state as the United States, where I have about to write a law review article called From Escobedo to Miranda, those being the two cases, outstanding cases about what is called due process, from Escobedo to Miranda, or the irrelevance of guilt. For the technicalities, and I was in the United States last September listening to criminal appeals, and every single one of them was about the technicalities of illegal search and seizure, or had the right warnings been given to him before a question was asked him by the police. And no one was interested at all whether he was guilty or whether he was innocent. One last question on this. Ought the courts to exercise disciplinary powers over police behavior by acquitting the guilty man rather than by disciplining the police? Because that is what we do when we refuse to admit evidence because of some evidence of a confession, because of some technical breach of judges' rules, or refuse to admit evidence of heroin discovered in large quantities because there was some technical mistake about the way in which the search was conducted. Finally, I think we have to ask ourselves, at the end of the trial, is sentencing a job which the judge does best. I think myself that the judge will have to continue to award the sentence at the end of the trial, at any rate in the first instance at the end of the trial, because I think public opinion requires that at the culmination of the trial, when their guilt has been found, that a penalty should be publicly awarded. And that is one of the reasons for punishment, to express the abhorrence of society for the conduct of which he has been found guilty. Now, of course, there are others. There are rehabilitation. There is the deterrent of others. But I have found it is now 30 years since I first started trying criminal cases, that the theory of punishment has gone round full circle three times. In 1951, when I first had to sentence prisoners, I made a point of going round the jails, of talking to the governors, and they all of them said to me, whatever you do, let us have the prisoner for 12 months. Anything short of that, and we can do nothing to rehabilitate him. So I used to give him 18 months, and that with a deduction for good conduct meant that the prison governor had 12 months to rehabilitate him. Well, then they turned round, and a short, sharp shock is better. Then it turned round again, and corrective training for the bad one, and some other form of fancy kind of imprisonment. Now it's come back to the short sentence because the prisons are so full. And while I don't think, indeed I'm quite sure that I wasn't good at sentencing, it was the part of my job which I found most worrying, because you never could feel that you were right. I asked myself, having looked at the penological theory is going full circle twice, who would do it, I don't say better, I say less badly than the judge? And I haven't been able to find an answer to that question. Now let me turn to the civil court. Because I started late. Now, the greatest failure and the greatest need, I think, is to find some cheap and quick method of deciding disputes of small value. Legal aid or contingency fee isn't the solution, because the cost is too great and unfair on a successful defendant. And we have got to face the fact that if we are going through the legal process as administered by the courts at present, where it is necessary to have legal representation, because they know the rules of the game, This is going to be economically far too expensive for the amounts that are involved. And I think we've got to consider small claims tribunals. I know you've been making experiments with them here. We have made experiments with them in England, and I've seen them also in the United States. But I think we've got to put the small claims tribunals outside our ordinary system of law. Not allow legal representation. Not to adopt the adversary system, but to have what one used to call palm tree justice, to have a sensible decision maker fulfilling the combined functions of inquisitor, asking the questions for himself, conciliator and arbitrator. And let there be no appeal from him on fact or law. In most of these disputes, there is no law. That is to say, there are very simple principles of law on which you can't go wrong. Judicial review there should be for fairness, to ensure that fair treatment has been given to the parties, but judicial review by the courts of law for that alone, and also for not mistake of law, but a deliberate disregard of the law, if that can be proved. And we have had in England some experience in particular fields of tribunals of that kind, rent tribunals, disputes between landlord and tenant, and in industrial tribunals dealing with the relationship between employer and employee. And unless we can do something of that kind, we shall not be filling a public need, which is one we never have really filled, but it's one, I think, of which people are becoming more and more conscious today, and their expectations in that regard must, I think, be fulfilled. I will go very briefly, because I started, I'm afraid, a little late today. I think another thing we shall have to consider, and already some provinces considered it in Canada, are whether personal injuries, claims for personal injuries caused in traffic accidents, ought not to be taken out of the court system, and liability without fault accepted, as has been the case in industrial accident here. That would have the effect of removing from the civil courts traffic accidents entirely, which I think represents some 40% of the civil work in this province, or at any rate partly, because one could either have, as some countries have, liability without fault up to a maximum, and after that prove your fault, or I think better still, liability without fault all the way in traffic accidents. And that would mean leave only that in that field of law, one would have to have assessment of damages. Again, I suggest that would be done, should be done by an assessment tribunal rather than coming into the courts. And that would lead the way to giving, instead of lump sum damages for future loss of earning power, future inability to enjoy the pleasures of life, periodic, the ability to give periodic awards instead of, as we do at present, making a guess, a gamble, which is almost certain to be wrong. Periodic awards can provide for inflation. Periodic awards can provide for the disability becoming greater or less than was expected. And I would hope to see in the ages that this kind of litigation is taken out really into the insurance field and relieves the courts from a task which, in my experience, trying an accident case after an interval, as we tend to have in England, of 2 or 3 years when witnesses' memories have faded, a task which the legal process, as courts have to administer it, does not do well. Now let me turn to the third branch of law with which I said I'd deal this evening, and that is public law or administrative law, which deals with the relationship between man, the individual, and governmental authority. And there, I think, that over the last 2 decades, you will find the greatest justification of our system, our legal system of the courts in this country. It is the proudest function of the courts to protect the citizen against usurpation or abuse of power, whoever exercises it. And in the modern welfare state, interference with the activities of individuals is a necessary feature of the organized state that we have it today. And that interference is mainly undertaken by governmental authorities, central and local. In where you have a sovereign parliament like the United Kingdom and New Zealand, and no written constitution, Parliament is by definition incapable of usurping or abusing power. That is classic constitutional law, but it is being eroded, and will, I believe, in my country, be eroded more during the 80s as we go on. Because it is no longer true to say that the courts have no control over any legislation. Over some legislation, they do have control. Legislation which the government has accepted as an international obligation on behalf of all three branches of government, the legislative, the executive, and the judicial. And we are being brought in England to an appreciation that there are limits upon parliamentary power by our membership of the European Economic Community, where we have accepted an obligation to apply the legislation of the European Community in those spheres in which it acts, and we have to apply it. And in the result, the way we dealt with it was by putting in the Act of Parliament a provision that future acts would be interpreted as in a way consonant with our treaty obligations, and through the means of interpretation, by the way of interpretation, we have managed to give the courts some control over the legislative powers of the sovereign parliament of the United Kingdom. I gather that there are reasons why I should cut short what I was going to say. It's very lucky for all of you, because what I was going to say was, if anything, rather duller than what I said. Thank you very much.
I was going to ask the Chief Justice of British Columbia, the Honorable Nathan Nemetz, to thank our speaker. I will do it on his behalf, and I know that I speak for all of you. And would you please clear the hall quickly and quietly? Thank you very much.